In our history, a song is rarely just a melody. It is a record of where we have been and a warning of where we are going. For decades, the Caribbean was a landscape of loud voices and even louder attempts to silence them. Power often hides behind the transmitter. It hides in the quiet rooms where boards of censors decide which rhythms are safe and which ideas are dangerous. Between 1970 and 1999, across the blue waters of Jamaica and Trinidad, a war was fought over the airwaves. Governments realized that a three-minute track could do more damage to a political regime than 1,000 protest signs. They did not just ban the music, they tried to ban the memory of why the music was written. This is the history of the songs they told us we were not allowed to hear. It is the story of the fear that lived inside the halls of government, and the courage of the artists who refused to turn the volume down. Our history is not a silent one. It is a loud and rhythmic defiance that no radio ban could ever truly kill. The year was 1977, and the heat in Kingston was heavy with more than just the tropical sun. Political violence was tearing the fabric of the streets. In the middle of this tension, the Jamaica Broadcasting Corporation was the gatekeeper of the national psyche. The government understood that the radio was the primary source of truth for the people. If a song could highlight the corruption of a minister or the hunger of a ghetto child, it was viewed as a direct threat to national security. The directive was clear. Any lyric that questioned the state or highlighted the growing body count in the political wars was to be scrubbed. Disc jockeys were given lists of banned titles. These were not suggestions. These were orders from the top. If a needle touched the groove of a subversive record, the transmitter was cut. We have to understand that this was a deliberate attempt to sanitize our reality. The government wanted a version of Jamaica that sounded peaceful, even as the sirens screamed in the distance. They feared the drum and the bass, because the drum and the bass carried the news that the newspapers were too afraid to print. When a singer spoke about the oppression of the system, they were not just making art, they were testifying. The state responded with the heavy hand of the censor. They argued that these songs incited violence or promoted a lifestyle of lawlessness. In reality, the songs were merely reflecting the lawlessness that the state had already created. The radio became a battleground for our identity. Every time a song was pulled from the rotation, a piece of the truth was buried. The disc jockeys found themselves in a dangerous position. They knew the power of the music, and they knew the weight of the government boot. Some complied out of fear for their jobs or their lives. Others found ways to slip the truth through the static. They would play the instrumental versions or talk over the most controversial parts just to keep the rhythm alive. The government thought that by killing the frequency, they could kill the movement. They underestimated the fact that the music did not live in the radio station. It lived in the lungs of the people and the vibrations of the wooden speakers in the yards. The more they banned, the more the people listened. The silence from the state-run radio only made the message of the banned songs louder in the streets. As the 1970s pushed toward a close, the pressure reached a breaking point. The airwaves were clean, but the streets were on fire. The question remained whether a government could truly govern a people whose heartbeat they were trying to stop. Every banned record was a brick in a wall that the state was building between themselves and the citizens. That wall was starting to crack under the pressure of 1,000 bass lines that refused to be ignored. The pressure moved south to the island of Trinidad, where the weapon of choice was not reggae, but the sharp wit of calypso. In the 1980s, the Trinidadian Board of Censors became the ultimate judge of what was fit for the ears of the public. Calypso had always been the newspaper of the poor. It was where the scandals of the wealthy and the failures of the politicians were laid bare for everyone to dance to. The government saw this as a liability. They used the Radio and Television Act to tighten the noose around the necks of the calypsonians. If a song contained social commentary that was deemed too biting, the stations were threatened with massive fines. This was a calculated financial war. They knew that if they made it too expensive to play the music, the stations would self-censor. The calypso tents became sites of intense surveillance. Government officials would sit in the audience with notebooks and recorders. They were looking for any sign of subversion. They were looking for a reason to shut the show down. Our history in Trinidad, during this era, is marked by this cat-and-mouse game between the lyricist and the law. The censors claimed they were protecting the public from obscenity or divisive rhetoric. But the people knew the difference between a dirty joke and a political truth. When a Calypsonian sang about the disappearing oil money or the rise of poverty in the urban centers, the board moved fast. They would label the track as unsuitable for broadcast. This meant the song could not be played on the government-owned channels, which dominated the reach of the islands. This was a form of soft exile. An artist could perform in a tent, but they were erased from the national airwaves. This created a two-tiered culture. There was the official version of Trinidad that was polite and musical, and then there was the real Trinidad that existed in the shadows of the band verses. The stakes were high for the broadcasters. One wrong track could lead to a knock on the door and a summons to court. The fear was not just about the law, but about the loss of a license. In a small island nation, losing your voice on the air is a professional death sentence. Yet the Calypsonians were masters of metaphor. They learned to hide their attacks inside stories about animals or historical events. They made the censors look foolish by writing songs that everyone knew were about the Prime Minister, but technically only mentioned a stubborn donkey or a broken fence. This was the resistance of the intellect. It was a refusal to let the state dictate the boundaries of the imagination. But as the decade wore on, the state grew more desperate. The fines increased, and the monitoring became more aggressive. The government was trying to build a cage out of legislation. They wanted a carnival that was all glitter and no grit. They wanted the world to see a smiling face while they held a hand over the mouth of the singer. This tension could not hold forever. The more the Board of Censors tried to sanitize the culture, the more the culture turned toward the underground for its nourishment. The airwaves were becoming a desert, and the people were getting thirsty for a drink of the unfiltered truth. By the time the 1990s arrived, the monopoly on the airwaves was beginning to collapse. Technology was doing what the politicians could not. The rise of the sound system culture in Jamaica and the proliferation of cassette tapes in Trinidad changed the rules of the game. The government could control the radio tower, but they could not control the street corner. Large stacks of speakers were now the new National Assembly. When a song was banned from the JBC, it would find its way to the sound system operators within hours. These men were the new generals of the information war. They played the music at volumes that could be heard for miles. They created a space where the state had no authority. Our history shifted from the broadcast studio to the dance hall and the block party. The underground was no longer a secret. It was a dominant force. The state tried to fight back with noise ordinances and police raids. They viewed the sound systems as centers of criminal activity and political dissent. In many ways, they were right, because in a suppressed society, the act of listening to a banned song is a political act. The 1990s saw the birth of a new kind of independence. The people realized they did not need the government to tell them what was popular or what was true. This was a moment of profound realization. The narrative was being reclaimed by the youths who had grown up in the silence of the censorship era. They were louder and more direct than the generations before them. They did not use as many metaphors. They spoke plainly about the police brutality and the lack of opportunity. The government found itself shouting into a void while the people were tuned into a different frequency entirely. The damage of the decades of censorship was still visible, though. A gap had been created in our collective memory. Because so many songs had been kept off the radio for so long, there were entire years of our history that were missing from the official archives. We have to work harder today to find those recordings and preserve those stories. The state had tried to delete the parts of our past that made them look bad. They failed, but the scars remain. The legacy of this era is a deep distrust of any official who claims to be protecting us from words. We learned the hard way that when a government fears a song, it is because the song is telling the truth. As we look back on those 30 years, we see a pattern of struggle that defines the Caribbean spirit. We are a people who will always find a way to be heard. Whether it is through a smuggled tape or a massive wall of speakers, the rhythm will find its way to the ear. The airwaves belong to the people, and the truth belongs to the wind. No board of censors and no government directive can stay ahead of a melody that is carried by the heart of a nation. The silence is over.